Want to be a part of the conversation? Then let us know on the TNT Radio Interactive Live Chat Room at tntradio.live. Lighting the fuse for freedom. Today's news talk, TNT Radio. This time, it's not the Martians invading. The new truth is more terrifying. War of the Worlds with George Eliason and John Helmer on today's news talk, TNT Radio.
Hello, everybody. I'm John Helmer, and I'm sorry to say George Eliason is in Lugansk without internet. It may come on. We hope that George will come back, but it's John Helmer with you in front of the microphone. In front of this microphone, you won't be hearing armchair generals or think tankers paid to run propaganda lines for NATO and the Biden administration. This isn't going to be the hour for rehashing what you've already read or you've already seen. Our microphone's fitted with a special filter to keep the propaganda and the false expertise out. We're not a crosstalk of reporters pushing their bylines and egos. This is not the BBC's hard talk, which is nothing more than a soft-scented chocolate confectionery made in the Foreign Office and MI6. No, this is the hour when you'll be able to hear the news breaking from the war fronts throughout Europe and hear fresh and original analysis of what the breaking news means. So sit tight, everyone. Here goes. Here goes. Today is somewhat more unusual than usual. As you all understand, there is an armed rebellion by a small number of mercenary fighters known as the Wagner Group, led by Yevgeny Prigozhin, in the southwest of Russia at the moment. This has been going on as breaking news since late in the Moscow evening, and I can tell you I've been up for most of the night since it began. What we're going to try and do for you is to help you slow down and listen and appreciate calmly what's happening and understand what's not happening and what will happen next. We'll start with some cautions. I'll then go to President Vladimir Putin's speech, which was given at 10 o'clock Moscow time. We'll then look at Yevgeny Prigozhin, who's the only figure that's emerged as the voice of this armed rebellion and the only figure facing the kind of fate that President Putin spelled out a little earlier today. We'll try then to talk about what happens next as an armed column is passing Voronezh, purportedly on the way to Moscow, and subject to all sorts of news leaks, news claims, none of which we can verify. So we won't tell you to believe it. We'll then go to what this episode portends for the future of the war campaign, the special military operation on the Ukrainian battlefield, and then move, depending on how much time we're taking, whether George is able to come back online, onto how the war in the Ukraine and the war in Europe is going from the Russian point of view and from the battlefield point of view. With these, this is the index, if you like. Here are the cautions. They ought to be obvious, but in moments like this, and this is probably the third attempt of this kind, or third putsch or third coup d'etat I've lived through in my time in Moscow. So I know about the panic, I know about the excitement, I know about the misunderstanding. We are in a fog of war. There's disinformation from all sides inside Russia. You will see, if you want to surf the internet and watch the Russian military blogs, videos that aren't evidence of what the Western press is saying, what the Ukrainian media is saying, what many Russian commentators believe to be happening. So in a fog of war, in a war in which disinformation and information warfare is standard part of the campaign, we need to try and act slowly, act deliberately, and obviously don't panic, but obviously don't draw conclusions for which the evidence isn't available. A second caution I have to say is personal. George would agrees with me. We've discussed this in the preliminary prepping for this broadcast. On domestic political faction fighting in Russia, we don't take sides, nor do we expose our sources, whom we've been speaking to all through the Moscow night and early morning, to the disadvantages which arise in a wartime like this. I'm not going to tell you as much as I know about the nature of the faction fighting. I'll quote you the recent words of Dmitry Rogozin, a well-known political figure, a critic of some aspects of the military campaign, a former ambassador, Russian ambassador to NATO, a former deputy prime minister in charge of the military industrial complex. Rogozin said, and I'm quoting, "I know the situation at the front as well as Prigozhin, and I've never hidden my position." That was a critical one. "But whatever the explanation for an armed rebellion, it's still an armed rebellion in the rear of a belligerent army. In a war," I'm quoting, "you have to shove your political ambitions up your ass and support the front with all your might. Any attempts to weaken it are nothing but aiding the enemy." That was Dmitry Rogozin's remark this morning, and it's one that we endorse. We endorse it by limiting the extent to which you will hear speculation about motive, about faction fighting within the military, between the military general staff and the Kremlin, between the Kremlin and other agencies, between the center and the regions. Now, there have been many episodes like this in Russian history, from the Opritchnina of Ivan the Terrible through the Drozdovsky March on Rostov, believe it or not, in April 1918 at the end of World War I, and the Vlasov defection and the recruitment of the so-called Russian Liberation Army, which fought with the Germans between 44 and 45. So armed rebellion isn't exactly new in Russian history, and this sort of mutiny under pressure by an individual with support from an uncounted, unnumbered a group of people isn't unusual in lots of places. To give you an example that's close to North American home, the January 6th invasion of the Capitol building, though unarmed, was the sort of mutiny that's been repressed in the United States, but is close and familiar to all US listeners. To our Indian listeners, they will all recall the Golden Temple invasion, attack, extremely bloody repression of a military rebellion in 1984, when the Prime Minister Indira Gandhi lost control of the, let's call it the military dissenters within her army, and attacked Bindranwala's forces inside the Golden Temple with a loss of approximately 3,000 lives. These things happen. The question is how to understand it, how extensive this rebellion is on Prigozhin's part, and what difference it will make after the dust settles in a few hours or days' time. So let me go quickly to what President Putin has just said. I say just. The speech was announced as an appeal to citizens by his spokesman, Peskov, at 8:45 this morning. The president spoke at 10 o'clock. I'm speaking in Moscow time. He spoke for 5 minutes and 34 seconds. Unusually, he was standing up. There were no edits, no cuts that I could see in the tape, so he was speaking live quite confidently, quite calmly, unusually calmly, with hardly a movement of his body, which often is an indication of how carefully he's concentrating and how calmly he wants the message across to the Russian people listening. Let me just make it clear to you how I interpret it, and then we can move on to what happens next. What is clear is that the president endorsed everything the defense ministry, which also means the defense minister, and the general staff, which is headed by General Gerasimov, have said already. That means there's no doubt, no ambiguity, that the president is attacking Prigozhin almost directly and personally and individually. He makes that clear by dividing the rank and file of the Wagner forces from Prigozhin himself. And in his appeal to the country, he talks to those, quotes, those who were tricked, deceived, to surrender and accept their subordination to the defense ministry, signed defense ministry contracts, and essentially abandoned the Wagner organization. This is the end of the Wagner organization, and Putin is offering a way out, an honorable, nonviolent, non-punitive way out for those who have participated thus far and who are willing to be counted among those who are tricked. Putin also speaks, I quote, of the stab in the back of our country. There is no doubt, and this is important in his way of saying it, that this is a rebellion that has nothing to do with the outside forces. So if you're seeing speculation that Prigozhin was connected to outside oligarchs, Russian ones, in London, for example, or the regime in Kiev, or other forms of outside influence, this is not the way the president of Russia has characterized this armed rebellion. And indeed, nobody on the government side in Moscow or throughout the army or throughout the regions of the country is making any claim this is an outside-influenced operation. It's a stab in the back of our country by Russians. Putin rubs this in, or let's say emphasizes it, by using phrases like internal betrayal. The emphasis there is internal, treason, and armed rebellion. The charges that have been brought against Prigozhin are Article 279, if I'm not mistaken. Yes, 279 of the Criminal Code, which is not treason. That's Article 275. Article 279 is armed rebellion. It's punishable by prison, but relatively more likely than treason. Treason implies the betrayal of the country for a foreign interest. This is not that. Though the president uses treason, he means it in a domestic sense. And he's basically saying there's no way out for Prigozhin. Though the president used the plural, they will answer for what they've done under the Constitution, according to the Criminal Code, under Article 279. The fact is, and I'm very sorry, you're now hearing a fire engine, a domestic fire engine going past. It has nothing whatsoever to do with the events in Russia. What I was saying before we were rudely interrupted by a fire engine is that the president has left no way out for Prigozhin. That followed Prigozhin's earlier negotiation with General Vladimir Alexeyev of the General Staff and of the Deputy Defense Minister in Rostov early this morning, approximately 90 minutes before the president made his speech. And since the president's made his speech leaving no way out for Prigozhin, it would be reasonable to conclude that there was no outcome in Rostov that that settles the conflict with a way out for Yevgeny Prigozhin. Now, we've reached 20 past the hour, and I think it's time to go to break. If the panel will bring on the break advertisements and announcements, we'll come back as soon as they're over.
TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
Why aren't our schools having people read George Orwell's essay, Politics in the English Language? He goes through it all about how they manipulate language so that words don't mean what they actually mean.
Gender-affirming care.
No, you're not affirming her gender. You're denying it. You're refuting it. Her gender is that she's a girl.
Sex assigned at birth.
No, sex wasn't assigned at birth. Sex was assigned at conception. Was Dad Swimmer carrying an X or a Y? That's when gender is assigned. Because, and again, yes, I'm a biologist, and I know there are exceptions. There are triple X, there are XXY, there are XYY. Mistakes do occasionally happen. But do you know what an infinitesimal percentage of live births those quote-unquote mistakes represent? In the law, there's an expression, de minimis, which is basically no harm, no foul. It's too small. It's too small to worry about. It's too much of a statistical outlier to even be a significant factor in the conversation. So yes, gender is assigned at conception, not at birth. But this is how they twist language.
You should hear what Timothy Shea is talking about.
Have you ever felt like time was moving too fast? Do you need a break from the hustle and bustle of your daily routine? Then come and experience Sam Sam Yao Noi, where time slows down and magic comes to life on the stunning Yao Noi Island in southern Thailand. Our private villas and public spaces are quiet, spacious, and very inspirational. Inside and outside magic spaces, you'll find exceptional facilities and a full contemporary art collection to inspire your senses. Our dedicated Sam Sam family is here to provide bespoke services to make your stay unforgettable. Let nature and our Sam Sam family team take over, and you'll get the utmost recalibration of your mental balance. Discover the enchantment that awaits you at Sam Sam Yao Noi. Book your stay today at Sam Sam Yao Noi and experience our magic places, magic spaces for yourself.
Book your stay in Thailand now and visit samsam-spaces.com.
This time, it's not the Martians invading. The new truth is more terrifying. War of the Worlds with George Eliason and John Helmer on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
I'm back, John Helmer, but unfortunately, George Eliason is without internet access at the moment in Lugansk, and we will struggle on without him. George is, as my colleague, followed Prigozhin's career a lot longer than I have. If you go to my website, Dances with Bears, and put in Prigozhin in the search box, you'll find only articles relating to Prigozhin's claims and the Wagner operations on the battlefield since February of last year, since the beginning of the special military operation, and one reference to the way in which Prigozhin comes up during the special counsel's investigation of the alleged Russian interference in the U.S. presidential election 2016. So George is the greater expert of the longer career of Prigozhin. I would call this event, as I've understood it and followed Prigozhin since last year, not the Prigozhin putsch so much as the Prigozhin pitch. It's not a putsch in the military or political sense, because as you can see, a very small number of men did a very small number of things in a regional capital, Rostov, and then drive up the road to Voronezh, where they will be stopped. Exactly what's happening on the road past Voronezh Airport, I can't tell you. There's mixed reports of shooting. There are mixed reports of helicopters down, as there have been mixed reports of MI8s and MI35s coming down or being shot down on the way into Rostov. I'm in no position to confirm any of this, and I'm viewing all of the Russian military correspondence, blogs, videotapes, and what have you, that are pouring out of these regions. I'd like to caution you against the US bloggers who make their living aggregating this material and calling it their own work and trying to charge you $5 a month or what have you for it. They are cribbing what others are more careful about than they are. About Prigozhin's pitch, I would regard what's happened as more like an extortion with a show of force in the expectation that there would be negotiations, concessions, and rewards for Prigozhin himself. During the battle for Bakhmut, about which President Putin has paid tribute to Wagner fighters for their efforts in that particular battle, Prigozhin made a number of pitches on, as you've all seen, vulgar language, screwed up face. I mean, the man looked drunk, and the man looked as if he was fabricating, and he probably was. What he was doing was pitching for more money for his units and lying his head off. There's no doubt in my mind, looking at the available evidence, that Prigozhin's claims about inadequate ammunition supplies or inadequate funding or inadequate access to more men, all of these are complaints that exist throughout an army, the U.S. Army in Vietnam, with which I began my career back in 1968 to 1970. Armies are full of complaining. They're normal organizations. They're doing a very difficult and dangerous job, and soldiers complain. That's normal. That's normal in an organization. It's also normal on a 1,000-kilometer front, like the Ukraine campaign requires, that one battle doesn't absorb more ammunition, more supplies than the general staff have allocated. People argue. Usually, they argue behind closed doors. Prigozhin's not a soldier. He has no military training. He's not even a good cook. I'm not going to characterize what I know about his business practices. I can only say I'm almost certain that I'm a better cook than he is. This is a man who's a businessman. He hustles for a living. And when he's made his statements during the battle in relation to his units, he was hustling. It was normal. And as we tried to explain in previous broadcasts and in the Dances with Bears website, he served a useful purpose, even though he was vulgarly insulting towards Minister Shoigu and General Gerasimov. He served the purpose of drawing the Ukrainians into Bakhmut, the so-called meat grinder strategy or the tar baby strategy. He made the Russian forces looked divided, unsettled, unstable, argumentative. That drew the Ukrainians in. They made a mistake. They've paid for it. They lost the battle. To the extent that Prigozhin served that purpose, he was a tactical unit serving a strategic purpose that the general staff had decided way above his head. His way of pitching in public as insulting, as personal, and as dishonest as it was, served the greater purpose. He was left alone. There are other aspects of Prigozhin's behavior that suggests, from a Russian point of view, that he had high-level protection to say what he said, to divide one part of the military from another, the general staff from the Kremlin, and so on. As I've already indicated my caution, I'm not going to get into that. However, we can get into what happened to Prigozhin to turn a useful idiot performance for the length of the Battle of Bakhmut into what he's just done over the last 24 to 36 hours. Has he changed? George's view, I'm sorry, he's not here to put it. George's view, oh dear, you are hearing some firecrackers in the background. This is not a military frontline position. It's just a regrettable external noise, which I will try to talk over. It is not a military assault on me or on you, your ears. Let's go back to Prigozhin. In my view, based on the evidence I've seen, based on the evidence I believe, Prigozhin has reflected a variety of normal complaints within an organization at war. He has support for some of the things he said. But at the point of time in which his unit was withdrawn from Bakhmut because it had served its purpose, he had an ambition without the wherewithal to sustain it, an ambition for more state money, ambition for more power. And what he did then was unprecedented. It's happened in Russian history before, but unprecedented in recent history. He went on a political campaign tour. He went to 10, if I'm not mistaken, 10 cities around the country, from as far west as, let's say, Rostov near the Ukraine border to Vladivostok on the Pacific Ocean side of the country. And he was campaigning as a political candidate. He was doing what you might call an Alexei Navalny. He never attacked. He didn't even mention President Putin. Instead, he used the name Shoigu, defense minister, and Gerasimov, chairman or chief of the general staff, as substitutes. He was saying, I know better than them. Support me. That was a political campaign. And it wasn't just like Alexei Navalny ran before the so-called Novichok incident in August 2020. Prigozhin did much more than that. He attacked and promoted himself as the alternative for military direction of the war. And he thought that he would be supported in the Kremlin for doing that. As he did that, he fell for the Navalny syndrome. That's the megalomania that comes from believing you've got a political mission, you've got support in the electorate, it's your mission to run a campaign, a political campaign. And remember that Russia is approaching a presidential election campaign between January and March of 2024. That's not very far away. Call it 7 months. 7 months. While there's no doubt that President Putin will be a candidate, I believe there's no doubt about that, There's all sorts of reasons why a man who believed he's on a mission, who believed that he had won a major battle in a major war, might run as an independent candidate in order to be, recruited and rewarded for dropping out later. General Lebed, had tried exactly the same thing with greater success in 1995-96, then advised and helped by the man I quoted earlier, Dmitry Rogozin. So it's not unprecedented in very recent Russian history that Prigozhin was trying to pull not only a Navalny, but also a Lebed. Both of those precedents would have occurred to the man. The problem is he can't control his tongue. He has no control over the public reaction to what he's done. He exaggerates and lies about his performance. Again, I have to apologize. They are firecrackers. They are not artillery pieces. We are not on a war front at the moment. In my view, Prigozhin became delusionally megalomaniacal, much like Alexei Navalny was, until August 2020, when he allegedly took Novichok in Tomsk, in Siberia. So what has happened is that, in my view, Prigozhin, almost alone, he recruited apparently no senior military officer, no senior police or security officer, neither. He recruited no regional governor. If you're running a serious putsch, you recruit and you build a group. He didn't. He couldn't. But he imagined he was essentially appealing as the patriot who won the Battle of Bakhmut, a serious exaggeration, accompanied by a pack of lies repeated over and over about what he did, what he was missing, etc., etc. He was appealing to President Putin in the end to choose him over Defense Minister Shoigu and General Gerasimov. This has been a total failure in roughly 36 hours. And that's what I would call the Prigozhin pitch. It's a hustle that's failed. Now, what we know from President Putin's speech earlier this morning is that Putin has been rescued by and supports the general staff without any qualification. Yes, you will see in some of the blogs, it's curious that President Putin didn't mention either Shoigu or Gerasimov. Well, he did talk publicly with Shoigu at the Security Council meeting, the regular meeting of the chief decision makers of the country on Thursday afternoon. We'll come back to what was said then after the break. But it wouldn't be normal, in my judgment, for the president making a 5.5-minute appeal to the citizens of the country in as calm a way as possible, as general a way as possible, to name any names at all. And from that, I wouldn't draw any conclusions about which faction has lost in this game and which faction has won. All one could say very clearly is Prigozhin has bet his life on a political stunt without military support. Yes, there appear to be a column of, let's say, roughly 50 vehicles occupied by roughly 5 men apiece moving out of Rostov towards Moscow. They will never make it to Moscow, but they will be stopped. None of them have names. None of them are broadcasting. And very many of them will simply disappear on the basis of undertakings and guarantees offered to them by the Defense Ministry, leaving one man alone, a megalomaniac who has been, let's say, tolerated for some of the useful things he said. And among those have been useful criticisms, not of Shoigu. He put it as Shoigu, but there are useful criticisms of mistakes made in tactics, mistakes made in logistics, mistakes made in supplies and priorities, and so forth and so on. These are normal arguments in democratic countries. What's so surprising to us all is that when it comes to waging a war for its defense, as Russia's been doing, there is more debate over the armies and the leadership's mistakes in Moscow than there is in any NATO capital. There's no such thing in London, and there's certainly no such thing in Washington, or there wasn't until poor Jack Teixeira, the Air Force National Guardsman, started to leak papers that showed that the Joint Chiefs of Staff, chaired by General Milley, were in fact dissenting from the war policy in Washington. The General Staff didn't trigger either a pitch in open. They used Teixeira as a front man. You've heard us broadcasting the evidence, and you can read even more evidence in the Dances with Bears. But what you have to understand or consider is that Prigozhin lasted with his criticism for as long as he served a military function and as long as he represented a broad variety of critical views about how the war was being run in a relatively more democratic decision-making center in Moscow than any comparable decision-making center from Kiev to Washington. Now, we're up to another break, and we'll take the ads and the announcements and hope that George Eliasson can be with us on our return.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
Immigration brings with it a whole set of problems that the left dare not discuss. One of the byproducts of having an overflow of migrants, both legal and illegal in America, is that our public schools are being overrun by their kids. The Center for Immigration Studies has done an analysis of recent information from the Census Bureau, and the results are frightening. The report, Mapping the Impact of Immigration on Public Schools. Among the findings, in 2021, 29% of public school students from immigrant households were from households headed by an illegal immigrant, and that doesn't take into account the recent border crisis. The 11 million public school students in 2021 from immigrant-headed households, legal and illegal, accounted for nearly one out of four students in our public schools. This is double the 11% in 1990 and more than triple the 7% in 1980. Immigration has added significantly to the population of students who speak a foreign language at home. Folks, our kids already can't read or do math up to grade level, and the issues just mentioned are bound to make things a whole lot worse. Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg for TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
Julian Assange dared to expose the truth. He dared to expose war crimes and corporate corruption. And he's now a political prisoner while the mainstream media censors and distorts the true story. In May 2019, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture, Nils Melzer, published a scathing condemnation of the injustice inflicted on Julian Assange. Melzer said, quote, "In 20 years of work with victims of war, violence, and political persecution, I have never seen a group of democratic states ganging up to deliberately isolate, demonize, and abuse a single individual for such a long time, and with so little regard for human dignity and the rule of law," unquote. And Melzer said, "This can only be described as psychological torture." Years later, Assange still sits in jail with barely a whimper of protest from the so-called free media.
You're listening to War of the Worlds with John Helmer and George Eliasson on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
This again's John Helmer. Unfortunately, George Eliasson is still without internet access in the Donbas. There's a few minutes left, and we hope he'll be able to come back. We are focusing today on the Prigozhin pitch, the armed rebellion in Russia that is still underway and still covered with what I've ask you to understand is a fog of war that none of us should be trying to speculate wildly without evidence. It will all be clear in about 36 more hours. But what will happen next? Well, as I said, I'm not going to speculate. George and I have talked to sources all through the Moscow night and through the early morning, and the best advice we can relay is it's too early to speculate beyond the group at Voronezh will not get much further north. Second, no region, no city, no armed forces unit, no police or security unit will declare support for Prigozhin. This is quite different, I have to point out, from the way in which General Alexander Lebed, then advised by Dmitry Rogozin in 96, during the presidential election year of 96, against then President Boris Yeltsin. This is quite different from the level of support General Alexander Lebed had following his performance in the conduct of the Chechen War. Prigozhin is neither the soldier that Lebed was, nor the modest man that Lebed was, nor the Russian patriot. Prigozhin is an extremely ambitious hustler, a businessman, and Putin said so when speaking of the political ambition of the man leading to betrayal. He used the words, the president used the words, political ambition. So the answer to the question, what happens next, is that the support Prigozhin thought he would have will not materialize, not regionally, not on the way to Moscow. He will not make it to Moscow. I could be wrong, and you'll certainly let me know if I turn out to be wrong at this point in time. And he certainly bet on a relationship he thought he had with the president, President Putin, that enabled him to relieve Putin of any criticism while attacking Minister Shoigu and General Gerasimov. So what happens next? The Prigozhin pitch will peter out. Now, the next question with which we started, so it's time for me to get to it. And the questions you've been asking me by email over the morning and night is, what does all of this portend for the future of the war campaign? For short, and I'm very sorry George Eliason isn't with us to add the what the folks in the Donbas, the political leadership of Luhansk and Donetsk are saying and thinking, so I'll have to guess what they are thinking, and I'll have to suggest a very simple answer. What does this armed rebellion, the Prigozhin pitch, portend for the future of the war campaign? My answer is between next to nothing and not very much. We can see already that Prigozhin himself, in his speeches and his little video clips, is making the point that he is not blocking any military operation or interfering with or the command control structures that direct Russian defenses along the line, or in fact interfere with the defenses as the Ukrainians announce that they're going to try and retake Bakhmut. Let's see how they succeed on the ground there. But this, if I'm right, and I may be wrong, this will peter out within the next 36 hours. Prigozhin will be left almost alone, and it's unclear what his fate will be, except that President Putin offered him a constitutional legal outcome, which is, if I'm not mistaken, Article 279 provides a punishment of between 12 and 20 years prison. Can a man with the megalomaniacal ambition, the overweening ambition of Prigozhin, suffer the indignity of imprisonment? I doubt it. We'll see what happens next. There. So we've got 10 more minutes left, and what would have been the beginning of the program that George and I had planned for you today is now a foreshortened ending. It's what happens next on the battlefield, and two or three very interesting statements entirely missed in the Western press on Thursday and Friday when they were given in Moscow are ones that I'd like to highlight so that you can think about the campaign, the war, as it's being redefined in Moscow before the current armed rebellion occurred. President Putin, at his Security Council meeting on Thursday, ordered what he called a reality check of Russia's war strategy. And then he answered himself by declaring the war will be over when there'll be no Ukrainian army left on the battlefield, nor NATO weapons. I'll come to exactly what he said in a minute. But that's the highlight. The foreign ministry answered by pointing out virtually at the same time that Russia does not recognize a legal Ukrainian state. I'll need to repeat that because it ought to surprise you as it does me. Legally, there is no Ukrainian state as the Russian government understands it. And the reason for that is, the reality is, that the mutual recognition treaty between Russia and the Ukraine was cancelled by Presidents Petro Poroshenko and Vladimir Zelensky in 2018 and 2019. More details you can read in the Dances with Bears, which will follow in a few hours' time. No legal recognition that there is a Ukrainian state. Go back to what Putin actually said at the Security Council meeting on Thursday morning. We can conclude, he said, they, the NATO powers, and the Ukrainians can certainly send in additional equipment, but the mobilization reserve is not unlimited, and Ukraine's Western allies really seem to determine to fight with Russia to the last Ukrainian. At the same time, we must proceed from the fact that the enemy's offensive potential has not been exhausted. They may have strategic reserves yet unused. And I ask you, he was talking to Shoigu, the general staff, the security services, and the foreign minister. I ask you to keep this in mind when making fighting strategies. You need to proceed from reality. That was a very important statement Thursday afternoon. Putin was followed a few hours the foreign ministry statement that Russia doesn't recognize the legal sovereignty of the regime in Kiev, that following the cancellation of the treaty between Ukraine and Russia in 2019, there'll be no Ukrainian state left to sign an end of war agreement. It was put this way by Maria Zakharova, who was asked at her weekly briefing this past week, when will Russia initiate a legal procedure to terminate the bilateral treaty with Ukraine on its sovereignty? Zakharova answered, and I'm quoting, "The procedure for terminating the bilateral treaty with Ukraine on its sovereignty is hampered by the absence of such a treaty. That's a cute way of putting it. It's ironic. It's amusing almost. But that's the situation. She went on, in Article 1 of the Treaty on the Principles of Relations between the Russian Republic and the Ukrainian Republic of November 1990, the two republics recognized each other as sovereign states. That 1990 treaty was then replaced by what was called the Treaty on Friendship, Cooperation and Partnership between the Russian Federation and Ukraine of May 31, 1997. But that's the treaty that was denounced by the Ukraine, and it was terminated on April Fool's Day, 2019. Well, who's the April Fool now? What Putin is saying is there'll be an end of war where there's no Ukrainian army left to fight. The Foreign Ministry of Russia is saying there will be an end of the war when there's no state to sign the capitulation. What the Russians go on to say, and we've got five more minutes to emphasize this, is this war will continue because it's the one between the US and the NATO powers and Russia. That too will have an ending, but it's much further and longer away. Now, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said on June 21, and I'll quote it because each of these words carry much more meaning than the Western press will ever report to you, and they carry heavy meaning once we look past the flurry of the Prigozhin pitch that's preoccupying us tonight. If NATO Secretary General Stoltenberg again says, Lavrov talking, on behalf of NATO, that they are against freezing the conflict in Ukraine, this means, Lavrov talking, they want to fight. So let them fight. We're ready for that. We realized NATO's true goals in the Ukraine some time ago as their plans took shape over the years that followed the coup. Today, NATO is attempting to implement them. They are directly involved in the hybrid and hot war declared on Russia. I'm reminded, Lavrov added, and he's quoting, of a Soviet-era joke that noted the Soviet Union is located too close to U.S. military bases. Well, as we all know, the Soviet Union was dismantled, but the war continues against Russia today. So what the senior officials were saying Thursday and Friday of this week is that the war will end when the U.S. is pushed to a safe distance. How safe? Putin asked Defense Minister Shoigu to explain in answer to two questions. Putin's question was, we know the enemy is to receive additional Western equipment. What does the Defense Ministry think about threats in this connection? And Shoigu gave a very long answer, but he said, we know how many weapons have been exhausted. We know how many will come, but the sum to be delivered by the end of 2023, as well as those weapons already delivered, will not seriously affect the course of hostilities. Then Putin said, Mr. Shoigu, what's the percentage of Western equipment out of the equipment total that's been destroyed since June 4? The answer is, and Shoigu gave it, between 16% and 30%. Why did they go through this, let's call it charade? Why did they say things in public they could have published? Why did they publish publicly this interaction? The answer is, as Putin said, the reality is that the percentage of NATO weapons that are being destroyed on the battlefield will sharply rise as the enemy's offensive potential is exhausted, as the strategic reserves, as Putin calls them, are used. When those reserves are used, there'll not be neither NATO arms nor Ukrainian men left. That's the definition of the war objectives, was given on Thursday and Friday.